the world here, people.
Oh, really?
Facebooking and the tweeting and the Instagramming, all that would not exist without our understanding of science.
So it's amazing that you do that as an insult.
You mean true for you is different from true for anybody else?
Yeah,
to
absolutely,
you.
Because I can't
think either got to be true or not.
I can't, no.
Good evening, citizens of Netlandia. Welcome to O'Reilly Radio 108 for Friday, May 6th, 2016, where we dismantle the current events for your edutainment through mostly rational conversations that'll make you go, oh, really? I'm your host, Andy Cowan, with my usual suspects. I've got Michael Robinson, Fred Sims, Stephen Griffith, and Daniel Atherton. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Welcome to the Parliament.
I'm taking my place again.
Excellent. And I hear that since the last time we met, you have gained employment.
Yes, I have, and now I've got other options. As always happens, once you finally gain employment, 15 other opportunities open in front of you, and I'm trying to pursue them all.
All the irons that were in the fire start to leap out at you. That's usually what happens.
Sometimes violently. I've had to dodge.
Uh-oh. Well, hopefully you dodge in the right direction, and everything comes out smelling like roses. We had no audience feedback from last week's show, so either we did really well or no one listened, or at least nobody said anything. But you know, we're human, we make mistakes, so please, if you find one, go ahead and let us know about it. Email them into us at O'ReillyRadioPodcast@gmail.com, or phone it in at 470-222-6759. Or you can also text us, we get all that. If you leave a voicemail, we're likely to play it. Because I like that, you know? Come on. Feedback. We need to know what's wrong. Tell us. Of course, you could also tweet us, you know, at O'Reilly Radio. And also, there's the Facebook page. You can hail us over there, send us a message, and we will get it, and we'll let you know what's going on. Okay. So, ranty segments. So, Ted Cruz decided after Indiana, after he lost again to the Trump, to drop out. That basically made Trump the de facto nominee for the GOP. And then all of a sudden, Kasich dropped out too.
And then people had to remember that Kasich still hadn't dropped out yet, and they were like, oh, crap.
Well, so, you know, he was that guy in the back of your head that you really hoped he had some sort of chance.
So let's be entirely accurate with this. No single Republican candidate, as far as I'm aware, has actually dropped out. And the frightening thing is, when it comes to this, the semantics are important.
Yes, suspended has happened.
Okay, so suspended versus dropped out are semantically different?
Yes, or and also rules different.
They're practically different. Okay.
What happens is this. If you suspend a campaign, every vote that has been cast for you, every delegate that you have had before that, you still have. They are still yours. They do not get reassigned or anything else. They're yours. If you drop out, then those delegates that you gain get reassigned to the people who are still in it. What is happening is this is a standard and very common tactic where they will maintain what they've got until the convention comes around and then do some horse trading because, hey, I've got these delegates. I can let them go and let them all go toward you or help you if you a little quid pro quo.
Huh.
So the Kasich-Cruz block could happen.
Could, yes.
Huh.
Where Kasich trades his delegates to Cruz for some favor, insert thing here.
Yeah, it's political horse trading.
And then those delegates, if there can be more horse trades made from other people who have suspended their campaigns, move to block Trump and have a contested convention.
Or, and I didn't say move to block Trump to have a contested convention. It could, if it does contest it, if he doesn't get the number of votes necessary, then, yeah, they could move to say, hey, go for this guy and completely shut Trump out and get whoever else they want in there. Or it could be, okay, hey, Trump, we'll give you the nomination, but we're going to expect a little bit of something to come back to us for that, you know, possibly, you know, consideration, not actual, but consideration of cabinet positions, things like that. Maybe, hey, throw some things, you know, say some good things about my state, or you owe me a favor later.
Well, Trump went on the record saying that he would consider Kasich as a VP, and then later on he would consider Cruz as a VP. I believe he's considering neither of them as a VP.
Well, no, he said he was considering them. They were on the list for him. Both of them have said, hell no.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Oh.
Actually, a huge number of people said hell no.
Well, yeah.
Fortunately, Governor Voldemort also said no, that he likes his job.
you know who didn't say hell no? Rick Perry.
No, he said, no, I like my job.
Rick Perry said, please.
Yes, he did.
After calling him in July of last year, calling Trump a cancer that should be excised from the party.
That's because Rick Perry is looking to, like, you know, have a job and be relevant again in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm surprised we haven't heard from good old Bobby Jindal.
You mean former governor Bobby Jindal?
why I just say Bobby Jindal. I'm not saying former governor, because he's not even deserving of that.
The stuff about his state going absolutely into the fucking tank, and then as soon as he was out of office, it immediately started recovering. That didn't do well for his image, even among his diehard fans.
Yeah, you know, sound economic policies are an amazing thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
No, the thing of note here is who is not being viewed as any sort of vice presidential candidate by the GOP, which is Brownback.
Okay, what for the listeners at home that do not pay attention quite as much as we do, go ahead and tell them why that's important.
Well, again, Governor Brownback, governor of Kansas, has thoroughly put in place GOP economic policies for Kansas. The state is in a downward spiral, and it's coming close to hitting rock bottom. They are hemorrhaging money. They're having to make cuts left and right. Cutting taxes for the top percent has not brought jobs into the state. It has not brought money into the state. And in fact, it's bankrupting the state.
Yeah, this is the state where, as we've said before, they went from under a Democratic governor a $700 million surplus to, as soon as Brownback came in, a $300 million deficit.
Yeah.
So and a $1 billion swing.
It's to the point now where Brownback in his own state seems to be alone now. Most of his local GOP no longer have his back on his policies, though he's trying to push through House and Senate even more tax cuts.
Shocking.
While cutting public programs.
Well, yeah, because how else is he going to fund the damn things?
So that he's trying to going, this will work, and keep pushing as it's being shown again and again and again. It's bankrupting his state. The terrifying thing, though, is while we have this abject lesson, a lot of other Republican-controlled states are going through with his tax plans, his economic plans, and are trying to push them forward into law in those states.
Yeah, for all of our listeners out there, quick history on economics and lesson on that. You hear all the people always talk about tax cuts, how great it is, everything else. But everybody has to remember, the government still has bills to pay, and taxes are where they get their money to pay said bills. So as soon as they cut taxes, where are they going to get the money from?
I'll
think about that for a while.
They don't get it from anywhere. I mean, people, in particular, when I was living in Carolina, this was a huge thing because it's a red state and they want you to cut taxes everywhere. And then they would immediately turn around and bitch about how many potholes are in the roads. And I look at them and say, well, where are you going to fund the public works to fix the roads?
Yeah, it's like, that shit's not free.
Well, the government pays for that. Yeah, where does the government get its money?
You are the government. Yeah.
Yeah. Remember, guys, as much as people try to dissuade you about this, the voting public, the people, the citizens of this country, are the government.
We are the government. We vote them into office. We pay them to exist. This is not someone else taking our money. Or ideally speaking, it shouldn't be someone else taking our money to pay for things we don't want or need. Ideally, this is our money, everybody's money, going into things all of us use, like roads and power lines and schools.
Yeah, just a little things like that. Yeah.
Again, we need another New Deal. We need public works, because when public works, the public works.
I wouldn't mind seeing a trillion-dollar spending bill that is all about revitalizing the infrastructure of the United States.
Because, dear Lord, do we need it.
Well, yeah. our infrastructure is decaying, but also, I mean, during that era, think of all the monuments that was built. Things that have stood the test of time and have become means of tourism, driving those local economies. If we had something like that again, we would shore up our economy.
I mean, there is a reason that Republicans are terrified of a democratic socialist, because the last time we had one, he was elected four times, and he built a country that went through a period of unparalleled prosperity and growth for 50 plus years.
With a corporate tax rate of 90%.
Yeah.
Yep.
Also, let's look at Eisenhower. Let's look at – I like Ike.
Ike was good.
That was the slogan.
I didn't like him as much as I liked FDR, but he had good ideas.
Yeah, but I'm trying to meet people in the middle here. I know
yeah,
FDR,
Ike was much more moderate. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to meet people in the middle here. I know most of us are, when it comes to the left right spectrum, we're more on the left, but I'm trying to meet in the middle. And with Ike, I mean, the entire interstate system that was under his watch, and that also is something that has stood the test of time. It needs to be reinvested in desperately, but it's something that gave something necessary to our country to improve itself.
Let's also not forget, you bring up the whole 90% corporate tax rate, and people scream, oh my God, I terror about that. But remember, under the policies they had there, yeah, if you did nothing with the money and set on it, it was taxed at 90%.
Yeah, it's 90% of profits.
Yeah, well, it was straight net profit, because if the companies encourage companies, and they get a tax break for taking that money and growing their company and paying their workers more and doing all of that. That
money was investing,
not taxed.
Yeah, it's 90% of declared profit at the end of the quarters.
You know, it's untaxed growth.
It's not 90% of their gross product. It's not 90% of what they make.
Yeah,
the way that worked was that they have this huge chunk of money that they earned this quarter, and you know, in that period of time before they have to declare it on their tax forms, they say, okay, where can we put this back into the company so we don't have to give it to the government?
Yeah, it's the same way that nonprofits work now.
That was a good thing, because it encouraged the richest of the rich to not give themselves huge bonuses for no reason, to invest it back in the infrastructure of their own company, which led to unparalleled economic growth.
Well, it grew the individual companies. Let's just map out how they reinvested. They would actually grow their companies, so they would pay for expansions, invest in technology, take that capital and invest it in improving the company, as well as that's where you had all those wonderful holiday bonuses and gifts that the company would give its own people. Mm-hmm. It was a tax workaround.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could take that money and give it back to your employees, and it wouldn't be taxed.
And yeah, because that is all bonuses is investment in your I forget what the economic term it is, but to
personal capital,
the economy, people are capital. Your employees are capital.
Human
a bonus
capital.
To your employees is investment in that capital, which is tax free.
Yep. Okay, so we're in favor of a new New Deal kind of thing, where we actually invest in America. You know, we're willing that I would certainly be more willing for a big percentage of my taxes to go towards public works than towards bombing another country that is dubious at best.
And if we spiked we spike those corporate tax rates again and force them to reinvest in their own businesses, pay their people well, and all that, I would immediately stop caring about the six-figure salaries of CEOs. They're taking care of their people. Now they really do deserve all the money they earn.
And you know what really grows jobs? A business going, hi, we need a new wing.
Yep. Absolutely.
New divisions, new technologies. We need invest in our own infrastructure.
And just exactly. to briefly touch on that whole trickle-down economics thing, which has basically destroyed the country.
Voodoo economics?
Yeah.
Three times, it's done it.
Yeah. So
let's take that term voodoo economics and acknowledge where it comes from. That's George H.W. Bush.
No, that was actually Reagan's
trickle-down
actual advisor.
Yeah, trickle-down came from the Reaganomics deal.
But in running against Reagan?
Oh, yeah, he used the term,
H.W. pushed that term to the forefront of voodoo economics for the entire trickle-down theory.
True. Are you doing trickle-down, Andy?
Well, with the trickle-down, you know, it's basically the whole theory was if we give it to the upper crust, the job creators.
Job providers.
Yeah, the job creators. Then they will obviously invest more. That is so far been patently false. They don't. They instead hoard it.
They put it in banks. They put it in offshore tax havens. They move the money out of the country.
Well, what happens with the money is it does not remain liquid because the robber barons, the capitalists, the ultra elite, they don't need to spend it. That's the thing. They don't need to spend it. They do not need to put it back into the economy. So they don't.
And that's another thing that that I keep trying to explain to supply side economics, economists.
There you go.
Because they don't get it. Money has to be in motion for it to have value. Unless money is moving through the economy, it does nothing.
Also, the whole simple idea of, you give all the money to this guy who's got $1 billion. Okay, how many McDonald's hamburgers can that man actually eat?
Yeah.
I guarantee you. You give that same amount of money and spread it across 1 million people who are below the poverty line, they can eat a lot more than he can.
Yeah. We know that that's how it works because that's what they did when the New Deal came around. That's how FDR saved the country.
Yeah. If you want the country to prosper, money has to be liquid. So the people that are keeping the economy moving, that's a buzz phrase too. Keep the economy moving. Okay, they've said it, but they don't intend the meaning.
Exit.
You know, the people that are living paycheck to paycheck aren't saving. They're not hoarding the money. That money goes immediately back into the economy somewhere.
Again, spending is what generates your economy. So you want, as you're explaining, you want the money to be spent.
Yeah.
And if you're looking for the creation of new jobs, there must be demand for product. So
there's not going to be demand for product if nobody can buy what you're selling.
Right. Which is what Henry Ford figured out when he was doing things. He was going to pay them a wage that was going to allow them to buy the product that they were making.
And that is why Ford took off.
That's why cars exist like they do.
That's why... Ford was not the only one making cars, but he's the only one we ever hear about because his policy was sound. He's the only one who survived.
He built the auto industry because he's smart enough to go, hi, I'm going to go ahead. Your guys are building the cars. Yeah. You know everything about it. I'm going to go ahead and build consumers out of you.
Now, sure, he didn't invent the car. He did not invent the assembly line. He did not invent the entire process, but he put it all to use better than anyone else at the time. So that's why he gets the credit.
Also of note, in his contemporaries – he deliberately designed and had made a vehicle for the masses.
Yeah.
Because beforehand, a car was a luxury item. And it had all this handcrafting. It was moving art.
But he got it. He got that the only way that you're going to make a real business out of it is if everybody wants one and everybody buys one.
And can buy one.
Right.
Yeah.
The ability to was... of paramount importance.
Yeah.
Now, I think that since we've now dove down into the history well, I think we actually need to talk about other things that have happened this week in history. Fred.
God, a segue.
Brilliant idea.
I can do a segue now and then.
Hey, we got segues all over the place. This week in history, brought to you by Christopher Columbus, who on May 1st, 1486, convinced Queen Isabella to fund an expedition to the West Indies. I think we all know how that one turned out.
A lot of natives dying,
Yeah, we bring that to May 1st, 2011, where Osama bin Laden was killed in Abbottabad, Pakistan, by United States Navy SEALs in Operation Neptune Spear. Thanks, Columbus. See, you guys see that leap I made?
I do. I do see that leap. I think that, you just wanted to say Abbottabad.
Shot.
That's awful. You are a bad man. Your ideas are bad and you should feel bad.
I don't feel bad.
I know you don't.
But my ideas are bad. You're correct. May 2nd, 1970, student anti-war protesters at Ohio's Kent State University burned down the campus ROTC building in protest. The National Guard took control of the campus on the 2nd of May. We'll come back to that. May 3rd, 1952, the first airplane lands at the geographic North Pole. May 4th, in 1626, we get the deal of a lifetime as the American Indians sell Manhattan Island for $24 in cloth and buttons. And then back to Kent State on May 4th, 1970, Ohio National Guardsmen opened fire on student protesters at Kent State, killing 4 and wounding 9 others.
Just a note about the American Indians selling Manhattan. You know, they did at least throw in the smallpox on the blankets.
But I'm bummed.
You know, that was a bonus.
Yeah, it didn't state specifically like smallpox cloth or regular cloth. It just cloth and buttons. We want to hush that up a
little bit. Call it polka dotted.
And circling all the way back to Christopher Columbus on May 5th, 1494, he lands on the island of Jamaica, which he named Santa Gloria. So that's how that turned out. So close.
Yes. And remember, we're America, not Columbus Land.
Yeah, not Columbus
Land. Or Columbia.
Land, and we certainly weren't the West Indies. So,
that's right, yeah.
You know, we celebrate that day for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
May 5th.
For America because of Amerigo Vespucci.
Yep.
Yeah. No, Christopher Columbus, let it never be forgotten, was a genocidal, homicidal maniac.
Terrible, terrible man.
Yes, he was. And we celebrate that because America.
But
I'm assuming it's a translation for Columbus in some language.
But,
I don't
know. But gentlemen, the spice must flow.
Spice.
Yeah, but he didn't even get any spice.
I know.
He got some...
Christopher Columbus is one of history's biggest failures, and he is lauded like he was a success.
He got some fruits.
Idiots.
He got fruit and he got sugar, which was a big deal.
I mean, we did get rum out of that deal because the sugar eventually got made into rum.
That's true.
That's true. Somebody else would have eventually found the sugar with the intention of actually finding that place.
Guys,
you struck out all the way.
Guys, it just occurred to me. Columbus, in 1492, sailed the ocean blue without rum.
Maybe that's why he failed.
That is upsetting.
That is a very upsetting thing.
No wonder he was such an asshole.
There we go. There we go. Problems of the world solved. Carry on.
Speaking of problems of the world... you guys may have remembered, you know, the year 2000, May 5th, 2000, to be precise, the Sun, Earth, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn aligned. It caused people to freak out. The Earth's moon was also almost in alignment, leading to doomsday predictions of massive natural disasters. Although this grand confluence usually happens once every century, so we're pretty adept at avoiding that, you know, natural disaster doomsday prediction thing.
Numerology, math, geometry.
You know, all those things.
Things that happen all the time.
And philosophy, as May 5th is a banner day, as both Soren Kierkegaard and Karl Marx were born on May 5th, just 5 years apart in 1813 and 1818. Fast forward to actual today in history. May 6th, 1856, Sigmund Freud. Founder, father of psychoanalysis. And... on May 6th, 1937, the dirigible Hindenburg explodes in flames at Lakehurst, New Jersey. And I believe we have a little bit more on
that. The humanity! The humanity!
It still makes me sad because that was literally the end of the dirigible era.
I would play the video, but you know what? I think we just need to move right along because we got a lot of traction out of the first segment. So let's...
Yeah.
So let's just carry on.
To say, though, if you find the video of that, I mean, give it a watch because the announcer, the emotion in his voice is, I mean, you can tell. Like, it was a big, big deal.
It's good stuff. I will put the link. Oh, I just lost the link. I will put the link in the show notes so everyone can go take a look at those out at our webpage at O'ReillyRadio.com. This is for show 108, and this will be in the 108A section, should you be listening and want to find that link. Okay, so, let's see. We have a logical fallacy. The fallacist fallacy. It's also fun to say. The fallacist fallacy involves rejecting an idea as false simply because the argument offered for it is fallacious. See how that's going? You know, that's kind of the slippery slope of logical fallacies. Having examined... See what I did there with another logical fallacy? Yeah. Having examined the case for a particular viewpoint and found it wanting, it can be tempting to conclude that the point of view is false. This, however, would be to go beyond the evidence. It is possible to offer a fallacious argument for any proposition, including those that are true. One could argue that 2 plus 2 equals 4 on the basis of an appeal to authority. Simon Singh says 2 plus 2 equals 4, so. Or one could argue that taking a Paracetamol. Okay, thank you. Paracetamol relieves headaches using a post hoc, quoting, "I took the paracetamol and then my headache went away. It worked." Each of these bad arguments has a true conclusion. A proposition, therefore, should not be dismissed because one argument offered in its favor is faulty. Example, people argue that there must be an afterlife because they just can't accept that when we die, that's it. This is an appeal to consequences. Therefore, there is no life after death, which we cannot prove. So, again, this is a logical fallacy. The fallacist fallacy.
And I'd like to point out that I contend that all math is a victim of the fallacist fallacy because essentially everybody just happened to tell you beforehand that 2 plus 2 equals 4. So I don't trust any of that. And I'm going to start teaching otherwise.
Oh, teach the controversy, huh?
Stop.
Teach the controversy.
Really stop immediately.
I have seen the build out and the proofs that make 2 plus 2 equal 5.
Rabbit holes.
Even a broken clock is right twice a day. You know.
I hate you both. I hate you very, very, very much.
If there was someone in the group I knew would cling to the math and the sciences, I knew where it would be.
Yeah, it might be Mike. Just maybe.
I'm not saying that I condone the violence and the murder, because I don't.
No.
Completely unrelated note.
Heavens,
I
no.
have a very nice alligator pond right behind my apartment building. Fred.
That better be a big-ass gator.
You know, there's...
Doesn't need to be big.
I don't think that this is a... This may be a fallacious argument, but I would say never get into an argument with a pig farmer.
True story.
That's a good point.
You know, just a word to the wise, maybe. So, let's see here. All right.
Hi, O'Reilly Radio listeners. This is your host, Andy Cowan, calling my voicemail to make sure that it still works. Please consider calling us, 470-222-6759. Bye.
Science, bitches! Woohoo! So there's a whole, just a bevy of scientific bounty for us. Apparently, we've been doing some science perhaps wrong for an awfully long time. I know. Big shock, right?
Yes.
Big shock. Because that never happens.
No, never.
Never, never, never. Never.
We're never wrong.
Well, in this particular case, one of our favorite test subjects, and that would be the rather humble lab rat, they may be suffering the entire time that they're being tested through no real fault of even ours, but a typical laboratory environment is kept between 20 to 26 degrees centigrade. And mice, you know, if they had it their way, their natural proclivity would be to be in like a 30 degree Celsius range. Pretty warm. Pretty warm, which is why they like to be around wires and things like that. You know, when they chew them, you know, they're always down in the basement near the furnaces and things like that. They're trying to stay warm. because that's what their body's like.
30, incidentally, for those of us who don't speak metric, is 86 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's pretty warm.
It's a warm summer day.
Yeah, it's pretty warm. Nice day in Florida, so that's why they're all over. But in more northern climates, that can be difficult to achieve. So, yeah. And I don't know if any of you guys have been in a lab, but whoever's got their finger on the thermostat in there,
laboratory standard,
it's cold.
That you put in for all the math is 20 degrees Celsius or centigrade. No, it is Celsius.
Yes. I think both.
That's right. They're both. It's the same. It's 20 degrees centigrade or 68
degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty chilly.
It's cold.
Yeah. Of course, they're all wearing lab coats, so they don't really notice as much.
Yeah.
So perhaps all of the studies that we've been doing with mice have been skewed slightly because the little critters are cold and they're automatically working harder to keep themselves at their right temperature, because that's what mammals do.
Yeah.
So they eat perhaps more. They burn more calories to stay warm. Perhaps we're just doing it wrong. Go ahead.
I think this. I mean, in some cases, yes, I think this temperature bias matters. But I think in other cases, it doesn't. I mean, behaviorally, yes, they may be working harder and eating more. But when we do some of the behavioral tests, or when you're just, you know, tracking a growth pattern of a tumor or something like that, I don't really think that's going to be terribly affected. Maybe the rate at which they work, but just what the result is, do they do X or Y, things like that, I don't think are going to be affected terribly much.
Well, it changes their metabolism. So, you know, basically the entire way that they live and digest things, and all of that is changed. You know, and it also, I've been in a colder environment for a long period of time. It kind of gets a little stressful. Oh, you know, if you're not, actually, if you're not well equipped.
One of the things that was noted, mm-hmm. Yay, entertainment. Going to Top Gear, of all places.
Okay.
They did a polar special.
Yeah.
And they went and consulted a number of experts. One, you need to take a lot more food and eat more often when you're in a cold environment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Colder it is, you burn more calories. Two, and this was the thing that was actually most surprising, was when talking to a polar explorer, you need to be ready to deal with the hatred.
The hatred?
Because you will start hating everyone around you.
Cold makes you cranky.
Yes. Cranky
and
cold, yeah.
You will get in... It's not anger. So we'll get angry and irritable. No, it's not anger. It's hatred.
See, this is why I think that the Canadians are so nice. Because it's the people that can stay nice in that cold weather that survive, because the other ones are kicked out into the cold.
No, they're not kicked out. They just...
They get lost in the snow.
And are never seen again.
They're just politely asked not to come back, eh? Hey, could you maybe go outside? Forever?
Maybe go outside and go talk to that local moose.
we got a real moose problem. Oh yeah.
That moose screw you up, man.
So
hey, what happened?
Talk
to the moose.
this whole study just it goes to show that, you know, we may need to take into account the actual environmental variables on the creatures that we're testing things on to get more accurate results. And yeah, unfortunately, with the razor thin margins that science is running on, it's going to cost a little more to do that, because then we're going to have to build better cage environments, you know, better housing for the lab animals. But really, we should probably do that anyway.
Yeah, looking at the actual article, it says that their immune systems were slightly compromised and made stress on their ability to fight tumors. Also, it had issues with obesity research and neurobiology research because of lower temperatures.
Yeah. And bad results at this level end up being bad results at our level. So if we want better science, then we ought to take care of the little things, like the right temperature for the animals. I think that'd be a good thing. There was another tangential story that I heard, which is actually where I heard this story from, which was from This Week in Science, another podcast that I highly recommend to anybody that has another hour. they were talking about some mice that were going through surgery, and the mice had a huge rate of death following the surgery. And one of the lab maintenance people noticed that the mice were not getting off the bottom of the cage to go up a couple levels to where their food was, because they just felt too fatigued from the surgery and couldn't move. So he just took the simple step of moving the food from that upper level down to where they were. And that changed the survival rate to 100%. From like an 85% mortality to a 100% survival rate.
Again, I love scientists. They're my people.
Yeah.
But we're still people, and we're occasionally idiots, and we do not think of the little things.
Yeah. So just that little thing went a long way.
Going back to being a supervillain, run every plan and every test by a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
If the 5-year-old can point out the flaws in your plan, you need a new plan.
Yeah,
you follow what the 5-year-old tells you and fix it.
Yes. Absolutely.
If you explain to the 5-year-old and he doesn't understand it, explain it so he can understand it or change the plan.
Yeah, here's a fun thing. Load an old aspirin container or something, you know, a child-proof container. Load it up with M&Ms or something and give it to them and see if they can open it.
35 seconds.
I bet they can.
I bet you they'll find it.
Bet they can. So,
35 seconds.
Little things like that. Okay, so another study moving right along. Two separate papers published this week, one in Nature and one in Nature Cell Biology, have reported culturing human embryos for nearly 2 weeks, going well beyond previous efforts. There's no reason to believe that embryos couldn't have survived beyond the 2-week mark, but the experiment had to be halted to adhere to the internationally agreed 14-day limit on human embryo research. I found this article out in Gizmodo. And basically, they're thinking that, yay, artificial wombs are one step closer to reality, which, of course, they are. But then there's that pesky thing of that 14-day, no, we're not messing with human life in a petri dish past 2 weeks. What do you guys think?
I can't wait to hear the screams about this. They removed that 14-day from the people who scream about abortions.
Even though this would completely fix the abortion problem, because then, well, you can just, if the mother doesn't want to carry it, you just take it out and put it in an artificial womb.
I think, from a scientific and other standpoint, I agree with that. That's kind of where I come from. I've had conversations with a lot of women, and some of them would still say, hell no, it's still mine, and if I want it done, I want it gone. I fully agree.
The point is that the existence of this technology eliminates that moralistic argument from the pro-life camp.
True. Also, I would also look at it in the way of women who, say, could not actually carry a child to term naturally without endangering their lives. Yeah. Here's the solution.
Yeah, that's the big thing.
Where devil's advocate question, maybe, discussing how it eliminates the moral question in abortion, where do they switch their argument to, now that the option exists for you to have that embryo removed and it get to viability and be a human being, that the women that are still choosing to have the abortions are just committing a form of murder to selfishly keep that? You know what I'm saying? Like, there's an argument there. They're going to find an argument.
Of course there's an argument there. They're never going to stop being assholes, but this is still gives them less firepower.
Oh, yeah, I agree completely, but I mean, if when we discuss things like this, especially, you know, it's a good practice to look for the argument, because, you know, we know it's going to be there. And in a two years time, what's going to happen is this story is going to be awesome. We're doing human embryos. And the next week, we're going to be having that same conversation that we just brought up as a devil's advocate question today.
Well, I wonder.
We've covered this question before, because this is not our first story on artificial wombs.
Oh no, not at all.
No, but what we're getting to is it's actually closer to a reality, and they have a limit of 13 days. Well, I mean, 14 days. So
14 days is the agreed upon international limit on testing of, of embryos.
Right, and I know that in the story they talk about discussing lengthening, like what would they even use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talk about 12 weeks, which is, I guess, in European abortion laws, or up to viability, which is what, you know, U.S. abortion law uses. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, that eventually you have to take the step as researchers to start doing this, because the things that it solves are so many. You know, the people that can't have children, the, you know, there's something wrong that they can't carry, but they want children of their own. You know, and it's just, there's so many benefits that it's a question that they need to start answering more than just offhandedly, you know, well, what are we going to use if it's not 14 days?
Well, I wonder if they'd come down to the point of, you know, being concerned with the price. You know, okay, it is a technology that is available to prevent abortions. Now, who's going to pay for it? Because if there's one thing that a fundamental conservative would have to complain about is how much something costs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that they don't want to provide any prenatal care as it is.
No.
They certainly don't want to provide any, you know, post-term care.
Oh, hell no.
So there's being pro-life and then there's being pro-birth. So, okay, so we've created a way that you can birth as many babies as you want. In fact, we can just go ahead and load up test tubes full of them. And you can make just babies all the time.
Are you going to pay for it?
But who's personally going to pay for it? Yeah.
Personally, I think that's where the moralistic argument should go. It's like, all right, fundies, you believe that human life is sacred and all that, so you're not going to let these people have abortions. You're going to make it law that they transplant their child into these artificial wombs. Well, they have given up that child. They can sign it away on the dotted line. You fundies now need to pay for that child.
Exactly.
See, I think actually you're going to get intercepted here before we even get to the artificial womb thing, because most fundamentalists will look at this as man playing God.
Yeah, no, you know what? That ship sailed when we started doing organ transplants.
It's true.
It's not going to that is not going to hold water for any length of time.
But it will still
playing God since modern medicine was a thing.
Y'all are both correct. Y'all are both correct. Yeah, that argument's going to come up.
And I acknowledge that absolutely and it'll be shut will down. Be an argument. I'm just saying it's not going to last very long.
Yeah, it'll come up and then it'll be shut down.
Yeah.
So
real fast.
But this is one of those things that, yeah, we're going to keep talking about it because A, it's really awesome technology and it leads to all sorts of things. And being futurists and forward thinking people, progressive people, this is a thing that we're going to have to deal with one way or another. So we're gonna slowly nibble away at the argument, and maybe we'll stumble upon something.
There's also actually going worse with this idea is the okay. They make it so that instead of getting an abortion, you go into the artificial womb. Okay, what happens to the children after they're born?
Yeah,
are we going to have a
whose responsibility are these children?
Beyond whose responsibility is it going to be more along the lines of we're going to have a situation like the movie Soldier? Okay, good. You've got all these children that are being born. Okay, no one's going to take care of them. The government does and trains them as expendable soldiers.
Yeah, I don't think we exactly want that.
You know, they actually, in the comments on the page, they actually, kind of an interesting question that somebody posed. I wonder if society would actually accept a single man paying for a donor egg to combine with his sperm for implantation into an artificial embryo. Being a single father, widowed or divorced, carries enough of a stigma, it seems. I wonder how people at large would react to a single man wanting to have a child without a mother ever being in the picture. I mean, when you look at
when
things
women
like this,
can do it.
Yeah, I mean, we look at things like this, and usually the thought we have, and obviously rightly so, because right now having a baby is 100% with a woman.
Yeah.
You know, the thought is immediately to women, and what do women want, and how would it affect abortions and things like that. But, I mean, that's an incredibly insightful question, you know, for men out there that are single or, hey, I don't have prospects, or gay men or something of that ilk that want children, you know.
Yeah.
How would that be reacted to? by these same people that are losing their minds over the other moral questions we've raised.
So many things in that. Oh, I love it.
This is an entire episode in one thing.
The whole landscape of human morality is going to change as this advances, because now that we've got artificial wombs, and you know, we're also doing genetic engineering all the time. What happens when we get to the point where we can take genetic material from two people that are a same-sex couple and make a child out of it?
Or just at that point, you can also have somebody clone themselves.
Yeah. What happens then?
You know, just straight up cloning. And, you know, yeah, what does happen then? Because also...
Because then we get to brain transplant and I just keep cloning my body so I stay young forever.
Well, your body would stay young, but your brain wouldn't.
Yeah.
So that's the problem.
Age.
Yeah, that's you'd have to...
The entire art thing with... discussion with Michio Kaku about being able to upload your consciousness.
Yeah. This all reminds me of a book series that I've been reading that I must get back in. I'm going to reread it again, which is like 120 hours or so of Audible. And... I'm going to then turn it into a game setting, because I think I need to live in that world a little more and to truly investigate all of these questions.
This is the one with the
This is Peter F. Hamilton's Commonwealth universe.
Yeah, it's the one that opens up with the surprise Dyson sphere and the trains that go through portals and all that stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a very cool, very cool thing.
I've read the original three not quite books thing.
Well, there was two books.
Well, there's the Neutronium Alchemist.
Those are in a different
Neutronium Alchemist. And the other one.
Those are in a different universe. That's not even what I'm talking about. No, we're talking about Pandora's Star and then Judas Unchained. That's the first two in this series, and then it goes into the Void trilogy, and then there's another book that he just finished writing, and then there's two more. So he's almost completed the series. It'll be out in print later this year. So yes, but it expands like thousands of years, because again, with rejuvenation technologies and cloned bodies and things like that, you die when you want to in this universe. So it's just a fascinating look at the way you then have to deal with people that are absurdly old when some people might just be in their first life. So it's just a fascinating look at things, and it raises so many questions that you just don't have in our normal day-to-day experience. So I'm going to go through it and really dig into it. I think it would be a rich environment to just mine for data. And we won't know until we're in it. Oh yeah. Highly recommend it. Okay. So let's move on to something a little closer to home, but still in the future. Elon Musk. I got two stories about Elon Musk, about his two major enterprises. SpaceX, he managed to do it again. He landed another rocket just last night on the barge at night and at a higher speed. So just SpaceX is doing victory laps.
Yes.
Needed more engines, but took care of it.
Yeah. Well, that's fine. If you've got the fuel... He can do it slower, or he can do it fast. You know, one way or the other, you still have to, you know, cut the momentum. But he's got the technology, and he's definitely zeroing in on exactly what he has to do with that. So
if the difference was the satellite was going into higher orbit, so he needed more thrust at the first stage.
It's just so cool. All the things that he's doing, so cool. Yeah, and the fact that it was at night. I mean, let's see here. I've got the video. Let's see. How long is this thing?
An hour.
Long enough.
Oh, geez, that's an hour. Screw that. follow the link. Follow the link in the show notes, people.
Or Relay Radio, not sponsored by SpaceX.
That's right. Not yet sponsored by SpaceX.
If you want to SpaceX, if you want to Elon Musk,
if you're out there, we're looking for sponsors.
Bring it on.
Yeah, I'd be happy to... Happy to fly your banner. That'd be fantastic.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking of other banners to fly, Tesla's Model X has a really, really good air filtration system. In fact, it has a bioweapon defense mode.
Huh.
That's forward thinking right there.
Yeah.
It, Is that standard or is that ad hoc?
Is that standard?
I think it might be standard.
That's
in the Model X.
Because only Tony Stark would go, you know what my car needs and I'm going to give it to the public? Bioweapon defense capability.
Yeah, Elon Musk tweeted out, bioweapon defense mode is real. This is what happens when you turn it on.
Wow.
Holy crap.
Jesus.
This freaking guy. This guy.
Yeah.
People think about, okay, let's make carpet standard, let's make these other features standard, let's make everything else. He's like, nope, screw it.
Let's make bioweapon defense standard.
I want to protect everybody from, you know, weaponized plague.
The filtration system apparently held up to lab testing, and even according to Tesla, started cleaning the air outside of the car.
Yeah. Yeah.
When the car goes, dude, your air is freaking dirty. Let me clean that for you.
The car is going to have a carbon negative footprint.
All the funding ever.
We need everybody to drive this. Suddenly, everything's great. Just replace every single car in Beijing with one of these. It'll be done in a week.
Yeah. That's great because they're not putting any emissions out and they're cleaning the air. They're actually carbon negative.
Yep. Awesome. So all the fleet vehicles in LA are being changed over to Teslas. Cool.
That would be nice. I don't know. Quoting from this, from Tesla, the air filtration system was put to the test in real-world environments from California freeways during rush hour to smelly marshes, landfills, and cow pastures in the Central Valley of California to major cities in China. We wanted to ensure that it captured fine particulate matter and gaseous pollutants, as well as bacteria, viruses, pollen, and mold spores. When we decided to take things a step further and test the complete system as we would on the road, but in an environment where we could precisely control and carefully monitor atmospheric conditions. A Model X was placed in a large bubble containment with extreme levels of pollution. 1,000
parts per million.
Yeah, parts per million, yeah. PPM to 2.5. Versus the EPA's good air quality index limit of 12. So 1,000 versus 12. So, order of magnitude. Yeah, easily. When we closed the Falcon doors and activated bioweapon defense mode. I don't care. I want a car that has a bioweapon defense mode.
I might never use it. I just want the damn thing.
Just to say you have it.
Yeah.
That's a point of pride.
Standard.
Why are you getting a Tesla? I've got asthma.
You're activating bioweapon defense mode? You mean your air filtration system? No, dick. I mean bioweapon defense mode. It's on the button.
Yeah, it's on the button, dude.
Don't question me.
Yeah.
Is that going to be the red button or the green button?
It's going to be the yes button because I'm not on all the time.
Exactly, yeah. Although it's billed as a bioweapon defense system, bioweapon attacks are astoundingly rare unless the occupant plans to drive their Tesla through parts of ISIS-held Iraq and Syria. They're not likely to ever encounter such attacks, and even then, a myriad of other hazards would probably make the quality of the filter mostly irrelevant.
Until we build a car that is fine with those hazards, too.
I need to buy a specialized Model X that's up-armored.
There you go, yeah. Yeah, you're not going to... It's going to really decrease your range. Just to let you know, it's going to really decrease your range.
It's fine. It's for base defense.
Yeah, so bioweapon defense mode in Tesla Model X. That's just, I don't think marketing gets much cooler than that, really. It's like, wait, I have to write an article on the bioweapon defense mode of the car? Please, sign me up.
The fact that the thing can seat 7.
Really?
They have 3 different interior layouts, a 7-seat, a 6-seat, and a 5-seat. Depends on how much cargo space you want.
That's
because the 7 and the 6 basically remove the cargo space.
Is that in the Model X?
Yep, I'm staring at the right now.
So the Model X is the one with the Falcon doors. That's the new one, not the Model... Yes. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right, that's the newer one that just came out. Okay.
For those of you with those 2.5 kids...
Yeah...
You can have the 7-seater with bioweapon defense mode.
Well, now that's much more entertaining to me. Though I will note...
So much more fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I will note that Chrysler is finally coming out with a minivan model, the Pacifica, that is hybrid. So it's going to get like 80 miles to the gallon. So yeah, and so that's the first in class you know, hybrid vehicle that they're going to be doing, and it's a hybrid, so it will also have the gasoline engine. That's something I'm more inclined to have, but it's not going to have, you know, bioweapon defense mode. So
yeah, he'll eventually start selling that to other car companies.
Yeah, well, yeah, ought to. Hell yeah, he has licensed out all of his patents for free. So all the patents on the car are basically open. Go ahead, please proliferate this technology. We need more of it out there. So he's definitely.
I can say the military will probably proliferate bioweapon defense mode.
Yeah, yeah, I could definitely see politicians really jumping on the bandwagon. It's like, oh, okay, no anthrax for me. Sounds good. Anyway, hey, Mike, your turn. Yeah.
Alright, passing along to me.
I'm passing the torch.
Okay. So, we all know how much I love space.
No clue.
I love space. Don't you lie to me, you know exactly how much I love space.
I think we know.
You're space core in human form, yes we know.
So, I have plugged these guys before, and I'm going to plug them again, because there is a new celestial event about to happen. And, of course, my friends over at SLU, another group that I would absolutely love to sponsor us if they're listening, finger guns. they are covering what is being called the Transit of Mercury. Mercury, as we all know, is the closest planet to the sun. It's a little one. It goes really, really fast. And it orbits the sun around, what is it, like 88 days? Something like that?
I think so.
So it goes around real fast, and its orbit is at an angle to ours. So oftentimes we don't notice this, but coming up, we are going to actually be able to see Mercury, the little black dot, crossing the sun. Now, obviously, you really should not go outside and just stare at the sun to watch this, even though, yes, you can see it with the naked eye, or more accurately, with a telescope.
Because you're looking at the sun.
Yeah, don't do that. That's bad.
Yeah,
there are no things you can do.
Yeah, instead, what you should do is go to organizations like SLU or any number of observatories, I'm sure, that are going to be covering the event, and they will, you know, run it through filters, and so you can watch it live as it is happening, and see another planet crossing from the sun, which is, you know, it's something that we don't see very often. I think the last time was like a decade ago that it was everything lined up for us to watch it.
Yeah, it was,
and we won't see it again for several years. So
2019.
It was 2006.
So,
yeah,
you know, catch it while it's here.
Yeah, the transit of Mercury we can see is every 3 years.
Yeah, so catch it while it's here. It's cool to watch.
Excellent. Because, every 13 you know, years. Yeah.
More space. We need more space.
Awesome.
Next up, onward. Something a little more closer to home. I'm pretty sure we mentioned this in a previous show. I know
yes.
We've been talking about it around the house.
The RSS Bodie McBoatface.
Bodie McBoatface is dead. Long live Bodie McBoatface. The organization, the Natural Environment Research Council, has finally announced what they're going to name the boat. They are not calling it the Bodie McBoatface.
Sad.
It is named instead the RRS Sir David Attenborough.
Which is good.
It is a good name. It was on the petition. That was one of the ones on the petition. However, they did not name it Bodie McBoatface, which made many people sad. Among the many reasons, this is directly from the article, among the many reasons the name was not picked, perhaps the most important is that the ship will be operating in dangerous waters. If the worst is to happen, such as it's sinking, the name would perhaps be not so amusing to friends and relatives that have lost loved ones. Good point.
It's a good point, but I think it'd still be very memorable.
Sir David Attenborough. However, the guys at the NERC are not without a sense of humor.
Yep.
They are not complete bastards. So instead, and Andy has so graciously pulled up the image, they have taken the name the Bodie McBoatface, and they have given it to the robotic assistant drone that is attached to this particular vessel. And they have called that the Bodie McBoatface.
I'm entirely okay with the remote-operated drone Bodie McBoatface.
Yes.
Yep.
There have been some... I have seen some some people being humorous about it, some people just being jerks about Neil.
No.
That's what you do on the internet.
People on the internet being jerks?
And all that. But
I have heard that there's now a petition to rename David Attenborough. But
yes, there is.
Oh, wow.
While there are some real sour grapes in this whole affair, I really think that everyone has had a good time with this. Really think it turned out as good as we could possibly expect. I think it's great.
Yeah,
everyone I've talked to thinks it's also hilarious. So good on them for humoring us.
Yeah, I desperately wanted there to be like a dinghy or something on board that was the Bodie McBoatface.
Bodie McBoatface.
Yeah. So that they've made an undersea vessel there.
I want a nuclear submarine that's the Bodie McBoatface.
The Bodie McBoatface.
Well, the United States could still do it.
USA.
USA.
Severely doubt that they would, because I've...
You there? Oh.
But anyway... So that is the ultimate fail.
Oh, you're cutting out, Mike. Mike.
We're losing you.
Mike, you're...
This is the NSA. He was about to reveal something about our military.
Yeah, you were about to say something about the Navy, and then you cut out. So I think they may be censoring you.
I was going to say that they have no sense of humor.
That be true.
That is absolutely true. And now finally tonight, and I hate to end it on a low note, but I think it's important. Harold Kroto, a Nobel Prize winning chemist, he died on Saturday, so it was after the show. The reason I specifically picked this one out is because we have talked about his most famous discovery many times before. This is the man who discovered Buckyballs.
Buckminster Fullerene.
Yes. He discovered the fullerene configuration of carbon, which is, a perfectly spherical atom composed of
60
hexagons.
60 carbon atoms.
Hexagons and octagons, or something like that.
Hexagons.
The point of the discovery is that it is extremely significant to nanotechnology, and there have been thousands of papers written about it since its discovery, and he has finally succumbed to Lou Gehrig's disease.
Oh.
So, good night, sweet prince. We will take your balls and go home.
and I'm the bad person.
Wow. Okay. And what perfect timing. That's going to wrap it up for part one of our two-part normal show here. This is part A, and we will go to part B here momentarily. And then there'll be a 10-minute intermission for those that are listening in the live stream. And then we'll be back after we do the necessary human things